This is an ABC podcast.
In a moment, we'll join garden design legend Paul Bangay for a chat about garden inspiration. And a warning. We're about to take a whirlwind tour of some of the world's most beautiful garden spaces. You may end up in a bit of a garden swoon. Just thought we should say. I'm Jonathan Green. This is Blueprint for Living, Places, Spaces, Food, Global Gardens and Design. Garden Envy with Mr. Bangay shortly. We consider the irresistible rise of Filipino food and celebrate Perth's first ever Festival of Design. Colin Bissett will be in too. Architecture and National Identity. Again in the Philippines, Colin has thoughts. But first, to the garden. Paul Bangay is an internationally acclaimed leading Australian garden designer, and these are his Garden Rudimentals, a blueprint series on the basics of garden craft. I'm perched on a couch in Paul Bangay's pergola. Hello, Paul.
How are you?
Very well indeed. We're having a series of conversations, garden rudimental wise, on inspiration in the garden. Last time we talked about Paul's method as a designer. If that intrigues you, that episode's for you on the ABC Listen app. And Paul, when you travel, I imagine you make a beeline for botanic gardens and the like.
I mean, it's funny because I come back and show friends our photos of our trips, and all of these are gardens, gates, paving, doors. You know, they go, that looks the most boring trip of all time. All we do is go visit gardens, really. That's, you know, our whole tourism is based on gardens.
Interesting that idea of the detail that you are taking pictures of. It's not broad sweep, it's how does those bits of rock go together with that little bit of paving there?
Well, I think broad sweep's a wonderful thing to see, and I think you're better experiencing that in person. Mm. But for me, I need to bringing back details is really important. Like, you know, how big was that gate and how many planks wide was it? And I can't remember that, but the photograph tells me all those sort of things. Have you ever put a search into your photo album gates?
I have not. What does it do for yours?
It works. It brings up gates. So, but just while we're sitting here on the sofa quickly, if we can, how wonderful is it to sit under a pergola on a hot summer's day?
Perfect.
Because last time I went to Italy, I had to write one of my books and I sat under this pergola and wrote it, and I thought, there's inspiration for you. Words came very freely and easily.
Does this one work in the same way?
Well, I haven't tried writing out here, but sitting here today, it's quite inspirational, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, as you travel, as you look at things, do you often have things in mind, or is it just, you know, whatever strikes you?
No, it's whatever strikes me. And I think that, you know, you get tantalised by the thought of going to visit a garden. Like, you'll see it in the magazine here, or you'll hear about it, or someone will tell you about it, and you just get so excited to go visit that garden. And you might base our whole trips around garden destinations where we know there's a garden we want to visit quite often.
Give us a typical Paul and Barry garden itinerary.
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, for Italy, I think probably the most beautiful garden in the world, this is a big order, is Nympha, which is just outside Rome. Now, that's open one Sunday a month. So you really need to design your whole trip around that one garden.
Tell me about the garden.
It's created from an old abandoned village. I can't remember if it's 13th, 14th century village that's been abandoned, and it's all crumbling. So all the buildings, all the villas are all crumbling down. But running through the middle of this village is the most perfect chalk stream. So it's perfectly clear. You can see the bottom. Mm. And that is a garden itself. It's just full of all these wonderful water plants. Right. Not above water, but below water as well. I mean, it's a garden. You just stand there and the water's so clear. And the plants just amazing. And they move so beautifully in the water. That's part of the charm. But what the creator of this garden did was buy this old village and turned it into the most romantic garden of all time. So all these buildings are dripping in wisteria or climbing roses, or at their base they have feet of like millions of wild irises. And it's just the most unruly but most romantic garden in the world. It really is.
I'm just thinking of the effort in all of that too.
Well, I don't know how much effort is involved in that. Like, I think they just planted those things and let them do what they wanted to do. I mean, we've said this before, you know, a casual garden is often quite hard to sort of plan and implement and look after. But I got a funny feeling this one, they just let all these climbers, it's mostly about climbers rambling over old bridges and buildings. They just let them do their own thing.
So what would you photograph there?
Probably the buildings dripping in roses and what type of roses they are, well, you know, the wisteria or, you know, what type of wisteria it is.
You're also fond of a cold climate.
Yeah, cold climates are good for plants. Should we stay in Italy?
Oh, why not?
So I've just got a few more in Italy. La Foce.
Which is where?
La Foce is just south of Florence, and it's a wonderful, it was only created last century, very formal Italian garden, but created on top of this hill. It all sort of directs you down to this wonderful point of Cyprus that formed this wonderful point to a peninsula in the garden, and then the views beyond that. And I think probably everyone has seen this one, it's probably gone around Instagram a million times, this lovely sort of curvaceous driveway that winds its way up a hill with pencil pines dotted along it. That's the driveway at La Foce. And so it's iconic, this garden. Everyone loves the drive more than they love the garden, almost.
What's this thing?
Silvio Pellico. In Turin. Mm-hmm. Now, it's open every now and then. You've got to really research this. Russell Page, my favourite garden designer in the entire world, created this garden. And it's very formal. It's a series of parterres. But the way he laid this garden out and got the proportions exactly right, the width of the stairs, doing a lovely Roman staircase down, the size of the hedges and the parterres. He's got a lovely pond at the bottom, which is rectangular and full of water lilies. Everything about this garden screams perfect proportion. So, you know, if you want to see a genius at work, that's the place you go and see that. The Villa d'Este at Tivoli, have you been there?
No.
Oh, so it's that, you know, it's up at Tivoli, it's outside, just outside Rome again. It's that really famous one with all the different fountains. It's the really famous fountain is the Fountain of 100 Heads, where it's a big long trough with 100 heads and they're all squirting water into this big long trough.
I'd figure you'd like that sort of quantity, you know, not 20 heads.
100.
Yes.
But the patina and the antiquity of it all is the wonderful thing about it. All those heads are dripping in moss, so they've almost been obliterated, the detail in them, and it's all just green maidenhair fern and moss. I mean, that just makes it so beautiful. It's super formal, but at the same time, it's got this lovely romance to it as well.
Isn't that funny how, you know, super formal can be broken up by stuff like decaying stone?
Yeah, time. Yeah. Isn't that wonderful? Yeah. I mean, I'm sure when they say you went back and looked at ancient Rome, all that marble was painted like in garish colours. And now we go look at it. It's
tacky,
all
tacky, tacky.
Apparently it was. And now we look at it, it's all so romantic and crumbling and, you know, got that wonderful sense of antiquity.
All right, where are we off to next?
I think we go to England. Can we go pop
we may.
To England?
Yes.
So I think the Great Dixter, created by Christopher Lloyd, is one of the best gardens in England. It's one of those gardens you can keep going back to. So a lot of gardens people will visit and they've done it and they don't probably need to go back again because they're quite static. The National Trust have frozen them in time. Mm. This is not run by the National Trust. It's run by its own trust. It's got a famous gardener there called Fergus Garrett, who inherited the garden or the looking after, the custodianship of the garden from Christopher Lloyd. And he's just as experimental as Christopher Lloyd was. So he's always experimenting with the garden, with the planting scheme. The architecture stays the same. It's got wonderful sort of big old yews in the shapes of peacocks and all those sort of things. It's got Lutyens house.
Just a simple touch.
Experimenting with the planting schemes, Jonathan. So much so that the paths have now come down to about 300 wide.
Okay.
And you have to fight your way through the plant material. It's quite exciting.
I think that's a really interesting thing too. I mean, you talk about National Trust and so forth. I mean, and there must be great pressure on an historic garden to keep that as it was.
Yes,
you know.
Exactly. And there's a great battle. I mean, so the next one, probably Sissinghurst, is a great example
of that.
That's
an example of that.
Yeah.
Let's put some red tulips in the white garden.
And the National Trust do like to freeze them in time.
Yep.
And so Vita Sackville West's grandson, Nigel, actually battled with the National Trust to be able to let the garden evolve. And they've now freed up and they're letting that garden evolve. So Dan Pearson, one of my great design heroes, contemporary design heroes, has now put a Greek garden in Sissinghurst. And so apparently Vita, when she visited Greece, she went to Delos and absolutely loved the feeling of it. And she always wanted to bring it back to Sissinghurst. She tried it. It failed. Now they have actually made it happen. And it's not a copy of what Vita wanted. It's Dan Pearson's interpretation of what she wanted. Rousham is my favourite garden in England.
It's William.
Whereabouts?
It's in Oxfordshire, and it is done by William Kent. So you know William Kent was the famous sort of architect and furniture designer. Mm-hmm. He actually designed this garden. And so it's wonderful. You go to this great big sort of stately home, and then there's a big formal lawn, and then you sort of just go down very insignificant paths, and it opens up to this woodland. And all it is clipped cherry laurel at a certain height, like it's about waist height, right through the whole thing. And he's sort of carved paths in it, but paths with lovely vistas at the end. So lovely sort of Gothic ruins or pavilions with statues in them. Sounds kitsch, but it's absolutely not. And it follows this riverbank all the way along, and it's just magical. It really is seriously magical. And it's perfectly intact. They've restored it and looked after it incredibly well. Really incredible.
They are such beautiful things to visit because they... It's place, but it's, I don't know, that other level of detail and intrigue and
it's,
being in a place but also exploring this other world of a garden in
and
a
it's
place.
And it's a whole different garden world. Like, it's a different style to anything that you ever see or expect anywhere else. That's the wonderful thing about it. And you don't know it's there until you go down. Honestly, it's just like a little dirt path that takes you down, and all of a sudden you're in this magical woodland. It's incredible.
But on that thing of sort of inspiration, I mean, that idea what to do to create woodland, or that sort of that idea of the clipped sort of monoculture within that space and the possibilities of that, that's an inspiring idea.
Really inspiring. Isn't it? Like, I think that probably the trees were there, so he had a woodland and thought, well, what could I do with this? And then thought, I know, I'll cover it in a carpet of cherry laurel and clip it. And so you get this sort of informality of the placement of the trees with the formality of the clipped underneath.
Wow.
Yeah. And the other thing is, guys, this wonderful rill that goes all the way through it. If anyone wants
the water, by the way,
perfect rill, like, this is the ultimate for garden designers, is the perfect rill. Yeah, there's a sort of a battle amongst garden designers to create the perfect rill. We've attempted to do it here at Stonefields with the channel of water and the snakes, but the one at Rousham's on a whole different level. It's probably like 400 or 500 metres long, and it's stone carved channels of water that then sort of they're punctuated with lovely hexagonal ponds that sit in a clearing in the wood. I mean, it's really. Yeah, everyone's got to do this garden if they can.
When you think of all the things that humans might do with time and fortune, you know,
creating a garden's a wonderful thing, isn't it?
Yeah. If you've got that opportunity, why would you give that a go?
Yeah, absolutely. And we're still enjoying it 200 years later.
Yes.
Yeah.
Where to next?
Okay, next. We'll stay in. Can we stay in England for a little bit?
We may.
Ensley, which is a hotel. Ensley, E-N-D-S-L-E-I-G-H, Ensley.
If you've been busy scribbling down notes, dear listener, I will ask Paul to give me all these.
Okay,
dear. And we'll, on the website, on the blueprint page of the Radio National website, there will be a little thing you can click and get this list.
It was an old hunting lodge. It's been converted into a hotel. Mm. Beautifully converted, not pretentious, very humble, but very comfortable. And it's in a Humphrey Repton garden. And so it's this magical sort of formal garden around the house. But then again, it dives down into this valley, and it's got big, huge gunnera ponds, cascades of water, beautiful alleys of trees. It's just a really perfect Humphrey Repton garden that's been perfectly restored recently. So if you want to stay in a hotel that's in a beautiful garden, that's Ensley.
Good tip.
Gravetide's the other one, Gravetide Manor in Sussex, which was the home of William Robinson. And that's been beautifully looked after. Beautiful hotel, beautiful restaurant in a beautiful garden. And all the food grown from the most perfect walled garden in England, I think. So that's...
Beauty and paddock to plate.
Good things to eat. And then I thought, well, maybe we should stay in Australia.
Okay.
Because we don't necessarily need to go overseas to see beautiful gardens. Harder in Australia. This is the thing about Australia.
Is that because they're locked away or because they're not there?
Well, we're really trying to develop it. Garden tourism in Australia doesn't really exist, does it?
Mm.
Not as much as it does overseas.
Yeah, I mean, open garden schemes and so on.
It failed. It closed.
Oh.
And now it's just starting up again now. So it's, you know, the open garden scheme was fabulous in Victoria, but it did. It closed down, sadly, and was great. But we have Cruden Farm,
mm-hmm.
which is the home of Dame Elizabeth Murdoch, that I'm actually I'm a trustee for, so I'm giving it a bit of a plug. But that's well worth visiting.
But tremendously popular. I mean, it shows the potential of this, of garden travelling as an idea, because people love going there.
That's right. And the thing is, that's a garden that the creator lived in for 80 years.
Yes.
So there's oak trees
that
there.
That oak tree that she planted. Yes.
80 years old. She sat under that oak tree at 80 years old. How magical is that? Cranbourne Botanic Gardens. I think one of the best gardens in the world.
It is an absolute treat. The shapes, the
it's just mind-blowing, isn't it?
Art that they have made.
I know.
There.
I look at it and think it's just like a wonderful, great big painting, isn't it? Mm. I mean, the way they use the coloured gravel and the plants in the same, that sort of swirling pattern they do on such a huge scale.
This is all, of course, Australian native plants.
Yes.
It's the companion garden to Tim Entwistle's Royal Botanic Gardens in the city. But that is a very special place.
One of the best in the world, and it's sitting on our doorstep, so that's another great one to visit. If you're in New South Wales, Mayfield is the one big garden that's open there. That's was a private garden. It's up at Oberon, so it's a bit of a schlep out of Sydney. But it is worth visiting. It's the vision of one man who created this garden on such a huge scale. It's such a big scale. That's well worth visiting. Cool climate garden. Bickley Vale, Edna Walling's little village she created out, out past Croydon in Melbourne. That opens every now and then. And I went to it a couple of years ago, was sort of blown away by these houses. She made the houses. She made the garden. People are still living in them and still gardening the way she wanted them to garden. And it's a real community there. And that's really worth going out to see.
The idea of visiting the garden, of keeping your eyes peeled, of looking for those details, getting out your plant app,
that's it.
Seeing what's that.
And can I tell you the best thing to take if you're a garden tourist is a tape measure.
Oh.
So I always have a tape measure in my pocket. I'm always measuring the width of a step or the breadth of a step, the height of a door, the height of a gate. Measure is the best thing, because a photograph doesn't give that to you.
You know your phone will do that.
No.
I'll show you later.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, I'm very excited now.
We will put Paul's garden list up on the blueprint page at the Radio National website. Before we go, Paul, you're giving us quotes.
Gardening is the slowest of the performing arts.
Who said that?
Max Griswold.
Well done, Max.
He's still alive.
Thank you, Paul. Let's talk about Filipino food in Australia. Now, if you're a dedicated foodie, you may have noticed headlines speaking of Australia's purple Filipino food revolution. It's perhaps a reference to ube, the purple yam that's popular in many Filipino dishes. But this is a revolution that's been a long time coming, a slow shift in presence of Filipino food in this country. It's a bit of a paradox in this. Filipinos are Australia's fifth largest migrant group. That may surprise you. But historically, there's been a lower literacy about Filipino cuisine in this country compared with a lot of other Southeast Asian cuisines that are perhaps more prominent. So, time for a primer. We have the perfect guests to help us through. Grace Quinto and Fides May Santos are co-founders of Entre Pinays, a collective of Filipino women working to amplify literacy around Filipino cuisine and produce here in Australia. And they are staging a special event as part of the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival to assist us in this campaign. Grace, Fides, welcome.
Thanks, Jonathan. Really appreciate it.
Grace, start us off. If you're going to generalise, make a broad, sweeping, ridiculous generalisation, the typical taste sense that would be strong in Filipino dishes, what would it be?
I would summarise it as the four flavour profiles, which we call the Philippine flavourings. It's salty, it's sour, it's bitter, and it's sweet. And the four flavours, they dominate most of the Philippine palates, and it's also sort of indicative, it's showcased in all the dishes that we enjoy as Filipino families and friends. So if we sort of like tapped into the first flavour profile, salty, right?
Mm-hmm.
If we think about it, we're a 7,000 island archipelago, so we're likely going to have a lot of salt waters around us. And we've actually taken advantage of that through the many things that we actually enjoy our dishes with. The first one being patis, which is basically a fish sauce that's made similarly to nam pla in Thailand and nuoc nam in Vietnamese cuisine. But essentially, it's a fermentation of either fish or small krill that's actually added into our dishes or actually used as a dipping sauce, a condiment or added part of a condiment and salsawan.
Right.
And then I guess if we go into the sourness of it, that also is indicative of our pre-colonial roots. I think sourness actually derived from vinegar, which was used as a means to actually preserve food when we didn't actually have refrigeration, because that only came later down the track during colonization and so forth. And one of the sort of marquee dishes that we would have loved would have been sinigang, which is basically it's a stew of fish or shrimp or meat. It's in a sour broth, similar to a tom yum, but definitely one that puckers up the lips and sort of allows your eyes to squint ever so slightly. Not too sour, but just enough where it's at the point of perfection and so forth.
Just the perfect pucker.
Yeah, perfect pucker, that's for sure. And then, you know, the other two being sweetness, that's in my heart. I love my sweet dishes. A lot of our desserts are coming from the Spanish colonization. We have bakes that sound very Spanish in name, ensamada, leche flan, and so forth. And that's really a sort of combination of our sugar regions in the Philippines and the addition of eggs and cream mm-hmm. and butter that came with the Spanish colonization. But then bitterness. There's one region in the Philippines that's very renowned for their bitter food that's added in through the use of bitter gourd or even the addition of the bile from the goat. So that's added as actually sort of a bitter amping up of a dish, which Ilocanos, or the people from the Ilocos region, really love and enjoy. Wow. Our dishes is a celebration of all those four, either in concert with each other or separately as well.
Fides, as Grace mentions there, an archipelago of 7,000 islands. That is extraordinary geographic complexity. I mean, how hard then is it to say this is a Philippine cuisine? That sort of variety must have great difference within it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, 7,000 islands, I don't think I've even travelled, you know, an ounce of that. I'm from Luzon, so is Grace, and members of our entrepreneurs come from different parts of Philippines, and that itself is recognition of just the variety of dishes and histories and stories. So we say 7,000 islands, but there's 18 regions and 81 provinces and classified into those three distinct islands of Luzon, Visayas and Mindanao. So there is many types of dishes and ways of cooking that's, you know, fairly distinct to each region and whatnot, right, and cooking techniques, which actually has evolved over time as Filipinos adapt to changing environments, place, time and circumstance. So, you know, we see from, as Grace mentioned, there's from the northern tips of the archipelago to the most southern, the nuance of flavours varies from province to province, bitterness in the north, sweetness in the west and centre, and heat and spice in the south. So I haven't experienced a lot of the food down south, and I hope to experience that my next trip to the Philippines. So we're on this ongoing journey of learning the food cultures within each region, because, you know, we only, you know, grew up with what we ate through our families and whatnot. So I think it's an invitation for us to really explore the rich culture of our food through these different regions and islands.
Is that a thing, Grace, that in the Philippines still, that the different regional cuisines are still pretty tightly held within that, you know, it's a thing of place? It doesn't spread or cross-pollinate around the archipelago?
I think there is cross-pollination. I think by virtue of Manila being the economic hub, many people from the southern tips of the Philippines go up there for in search of a better future. Or you have like a dish called Bicol Express, which when we looked back at, you know, how did that come to be? The Bicol Express came to Manila. It was actually a dish that was originated in Manila, though the thought of Bicol is the fact that there's reverence to the heat that Bicol region actually brings to their dishes. But what we found out, it was actually invented in Manila through a person that sort of migrated from Bicol into Manila and actually just wanted to sort of like reminisce about the flavors that they missed from home. And so you probably will find that cross-pollination of regional dishes popping up in Manila and the Luzon region, which is a key island region where many of the economic and political and social potential opportunities exist. But yeah, that's also been seen in the global diaspora of where the Filipinos have spread.
Fidesz, we'll come to the sort of the influence of colonization and of American influence as well. But before we get to that, especially around techniques, the ideas from pre-colonial times in Filipino cuisine, what persists there?
Some of the pre-colonial influences that still exist today are primarily preservation techniques, right? So Filipinos have a long history of using preservation techniques to extend the shelf life of food, such as drying, smoking, pickling, and fermentation, which we're actually seeing a trend in right now. These techniques were used in pre-colonial times to ensure that stable food supply, especially during times of scarcity, as well as, I guess, the climate. You know, I remember every time we visited the Philippines, there's one dish that my Lola always cooked, which is adobo, because the drive to the airport, for example, for our arrival and departure would take a few hours. So she needed to feed the family, and it was always adobo because of the vinegar, and it was able to be kept in the caldero, in the back of the jeepney. And so that has been obviously, a technique that's been passed down from the generations. And then obviously, you know, there are dishes like, which is fairly particular to the region I grew up in, Pampanga, which is burro, also using a fermentation type of technique using rice and salted fish. It gets put into a little dark corner for a few days, and then you utilize that in dishes as a side dish to go with the main meal. So it's really interesting to just learn about these techniques and how they're actually becoming more, popular right now, and people trying to learn about these techniques to utilize in current cooking and ways of eating.
Well, it is so interesting that the wheel turns, doesn't it? We begin to examine things which have stood the test of time. We ask ourselves why? Well, because they're really good ideas and taste good, I guess, is the simple response to it. I mean, Grace, Spanish colonization has, of course, had a dramatic influence over the Philippines, and I suspect in food that was part of the broader picture. What happened to Filipino cooking when the Spanish came?
So when the Spanish came, they obviously brought with them their rich cuisines and taste. We don't traditionally have much milk-based products, dairy milk, that is. We use a lot of coconuts for our milky sort of desserts. But when they came along, they really wanted to, recreate some of the dishes that they were used to back in their cocina. So they brought along eggs, they brought along the butter, flour, sugar. And as a result, you will find a lot of desserts that are named with very Spanish-sounding names, like, as I mentioned before, tocino de consello, leche flan, ensamada, and alike. But one of the things that people don't quite realize is most of our food, whilst it sounds very Spanish, a lot of that is actually tied into Mexican roots. And I think, for example, what people didn't realize is when the Spaniards come, they would do a lot of trade between the Philippines, which was considered their Asian quarters, and then they would actually trade across to the Americas, and that was referred to as a galleon trade. And as a result, a lot of our dishes actually pay more homage to the Mexican roots than it did to the Spanish roots. We have a lot of dishes that use, for example, ingredients that are quite native in Mexico, such as achuete or anato seed, which is, this seed that actually when you crush down, it gives you this beautiful red orange hue that's actually added to a lot of our dishes like menudo or afritada, which sounds Spanish in its naming convention, but it's actually sort of tied into an ingredient that was sourced from Mexico instead of Spain.
The other big influence, Grace, was of course that of the United States, not necessarily globally thought of as a positive influence on food cultures. What happened to Filipino food as a result of American presence?
The American presence really sort of brought along the advent of processed food, which I think is probably not something that we should continue to eat, given the fact that that's, I think, I would say, sort of attributable to the high blood pressure as well as diabetes that many Filipinos now have to sort of like suffer through and so forth. But it did bring along also the reverence to Western brands, which I think also is a shame, because I think one of the things that you will find when you go back to the Philippines is people seek to eat at, you know, Western restaurants as opposed to enjoying the restaurants that really celebrate our cultural roots. But we're actually starting to see a change in that. When we sort of like work with some of the culinarians back in the Philippines, you can really see them starting to embrace that pre-colonial sort of cooking techniques as well as ingredients, starting to shun away from what actually was imposed upon them through the US occupation of the Philippines. Because I think, you know, unfortunately, like many colonized regions, we still have reverence to our colonizer, but we're starting to see that being unwound by the newer and younger generation that are looking to sort of embrace what came before they occupied our lands.
Grace, this is where the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival comes into the picture, and this process of breaking cover. Tell us what's happening there.
So on the last weekend of Melbourne Food and Wine, on the 1st and the 2nd, we will be hosting a weekend full of fiesta time at the Mission to Seafarers, which is a historic site in the Docklands, which provide rest and respite and other social welfare services to seafarers that come and port in our Melbourne city. So we're using that site because it's in honour of the fact that about 60% of seafarers that come into Melbourne are of Filipino heritage. And so we really wanted to sort of celebrate that history as well as the present circumstances, but do it in a way that's quite unique. So the first day we'll be doing a launch of the Calamanset story, which is both a publication and a documentary, where we worked with a production team from the Philippines, Irwan Husoff of Feature Films, and we will be showcasing that as part of the Saturday event together with an anthology of Filipino migrant stories, which will be a publication. And part of this will also then foray into Sunday, which we're gathering together our barrio of Filipino food vendors, and these are both small and big name people from our Filipino food scene here in Melbourne and Sydney, and we're going to be offering what Fidesz has been alluding to, and that is the fiesta vibes over here in Melbourne, and bring lots of food, lots of fun. One of the things that we'll highlight is the fact that the calamanset is going to be our hero ingredient and will hopefully be seen in both the seafood kamayan as well as the DV cider collaboration that we did together with Jenny Abulos from DV Cider.
Sounds delicious and it sounds exciting. Thank you both, and congratulations on those efforts and your work too in propelling this Australian enthusiasm for Filipino food. Much appreciate your time.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Thank you so much, Jonathan.
That was Grace Ginto and Fidesme Santos, co-founders of Filipina Australian Women's Collective, the Entrepinas. Their Melbourne Food and Wine Festival event, Seafood Stars and Stories Seafarers, happening, it's April 1 and 2. We will put a link if you're passing through Melbourne or in town and keen to have your senses delighted, a link to that on the Blueprint page at the Radio National website. It's the Blueprint for Living, ABC RN. Now, Perth might not be the first place you think of in a conversation about design. Something about that city feels utilitarian, brash, sort of a build it and knock it down ethos. However, changes are afoot in what's the world's most geographically isolated city. Now, interestingly, the work of those good people in Perth engaged in this design disciplines is popping into the foreground, and a new image of that capital is forming. Less mining, more imagination. And it's all coming together in the inaugural Perth Design Week. Sandy Angie and David Smith are the week's co-founders. They're designers in their own right, but wear many hats. Sandy's also a councillor at the City of Perth. David is the WA State Chair of the Design Institute of Australia. Welcome to you both.
Thank you for having us.
Hi, Jonathan.
Congratulations to begin with. Perth Design Week, a splendid notion. Sandy, what are the origins of that idea? How did this story begin?
The story began actually with David and I both coming up with this idea independently. So we both had started chipping away at creating a design week in Perth. And then we somehow found each other and started working on this together over a year ago now. And our concept was this coalition of the willing, where we thought we both, I guess, are quite well connected in the design community. And we just rang around everyone we knew and said, well, look, we all put events on anyway. If we just all reshuffle our calendars and do an event or two in a particular week, we've got the start of a design week, and that's exactly what happened.
Why is it important to have that sort of centre of gravity?
I think it's really important because, you know, as you mentioned in your introduction, Perth is probably not well known for design, and yet we've got this huge and creative community, this ecosystem, and it's really important to celebrate that and to bring it out into the public and let people know all of the great work that the Perth design community is doing.
And David, you come to this background in furniture design, among other things, which it's a wonderful discipline to bring to this.
Yes, that was a period of my career which has been incredibly mixed and diverse. Certainly the most enjoyable period of my career. It wasn't particularly sustainable, but that's one of the reasons I guess I'm so passionate about supporting people who are in that space now. The industry has changed a lot, thankfully, and there's some incredible work being done, which obviously this is what this festival is about, celebrating that.
Do you have a feeling of that work being a bit underrepresented?
You mean in Western Australia?
Well, Western Australia and then more broadly, I guess.
Product design in Australia is a really interesting industry. The days of kind of mass production, injection molding, those kinds of things, all of that work seems to have really gone offshore. So I think that's ultimately probably been a good thing for the industry. It's probably caused people to focus on the kind of work that they can achieve at sort of smaller scales and with smaller production runs and things like that, which has, I think that's taken furniture into a very healthy place.
And Sandy, architecture is your go. Perth's architectural palette, how would you describe that?
Oh, it's unique, and that's the way it should be. I think with globalisation and, you know, the image being broadcast across the world through Instagram and various other mediums, it's, I guess, the real danger of architecture being homogenised. And I think Perth really has its own sense of place, and our architects have their own unique style, and that should be celebrated, and that's what this week's about.
How does that look? How would you describe that to a person who had no sense of Perth, and perhaps give us a sense too of what place does to that aesthetic?
Yeah, I guess, you know, with Perth, it's, you know, blue, clear blue skies without clouds, and, you know, a long landscape and horizons, and, you know, we've got, you know, I guess, sprawling suburbs, you know, north, south and east, and, you know, a city that is relatively young and therefore the architecture is young. And I guess, you know, a focus on, in a sense, it's a mining city, a resources city, and, you know, what influence does that have on our architecture and our streetscape? So I don't know it's really difficult to describe, really, because we live it.
No, that's beautifully evocative.
We live it every day, and for us, it's Perth, it's normal.
I do have this kind of image in my head of this Perth palette, if you like, which is this, like you say, this kind of really clean blue skies, deep greens of the bush sitting alongside brick and terracotta. Those are the kind of colours and the palette that I think of when someone says Perth architecture. And I think that the dominance of brick in construction here is a pretty unique thing, and it continues to this day. There's lots of arguments about why that is. The rest of the world has embraced, you know, timber and frame construction, I think, more than we have.
I wonder if part of that is a sense of that thing that Sandy suggests, David, of the city perched on a great emptiness. Well, it's not an emptiness at all, but a city perched on the broad expanse of country, and then the need for a sense of solidity in the built form. Is that part of that?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think you're right. We are perched on the very edge of a great desert, really, and we're amongst the dunes, and maybe you're right, there is a sense of wanting some kind of weight and monument behind it.
And I wonder, Sandy, if things like a design week give the opportunity for those sorts of reflections to, yeah, what are we about? What does make us in a design, architectural and aesthetic sense?
Well, I think you've given us a really good topic for our 2024 Design Week? Because this Design Week, it's a beautiful question that we could perhaps ask next year, because I guess, you know, it does take someone, from outside Perth to ask that question, because I guess we didn't curate the program this year. It was an open invitation for the design community to contribute. So we didn't prescribe what needed to be considered. Questions and conversations have just arisen and formed part of the program.
What floated to the top from that process?
Yeah, so two of the key themes that really emerged this year is designing with country and sustainability, and obviously both of those topics are linked. And the first day of the program, which was Thursday, the event opened with a designing with country discussion led by the Planning Institute, and then another event on that theme held by the Property Council in the evening.
A very deep, very rich subject, especially for a city like Perth, which strikes me as a place of very proud sort of modernity. To introduce that idea of country and the response to it is that's a really rich conversation.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And I guess now the question, it's something that's fundamental to all design in WA and, a really important conversation to have in Design Week.
One of the other big things, David, is an exhibition of Australian design icons at Perth Council House. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is a collection by a gentleman called Ian Wong, who is a design educator at Monash University. This is a collection that he has exhibited all around the world. And when I saw this collection a few years ago, it was really a major kind of catalyst for me for this whole event, wanting to get that collection across and in front of the WA public. I think there's like 2,500 pieces in his whole collection. Mm. We've got a small selection of that here, but this is really about, I guess, a reflection on the amazing design work that has formed, I guess, part of all of our everyday lives that we may not necessarily have understood. These are products that were designed and made in Australia. So there's lots of familiar objects in there from our childhoods, and I think the nostalgia aspect is has really affected people.
Always strong.
yes.
But to take it back to Perth and to David to furniture again, tell us about Charles Catt.
Well, Catt Furniture, established by Charles Catt, I think back in the 1950s or early 60s, was a major success in Western Australia, creating solid timber furniture, largely from Jarra, which was quite abundant at the time. So, yeah, they were a real success story. I think most West Australians had Catt Furniture in their homes. The company is sadly no more, but so these pieces are now really becoming much more sought after.
What sort of style are we talking about?
It's kind of a fairly, I guess, progressive style of the time. Some of it's quite brutal, but really just about, I guess, celebrating the timber, simple forms, and that kind of slightly brutalist style of construction is, I guess, the thing that's increasing in popularity now. So people are really starting to try to hunt these pieces down. Thankfully, Ian has a couple of pieces in his collection. One of them he has just acquired here in Perth, and that'll be on show at Icons as well.
I'm just loving the fact there's Catt Furniture. It's just a beautiful and evocative name.
Yeah, we had it in our home in the 90s.
Yeah. Yeah, look, I think, and as did my in-laws, they had Catt dining tables and dining chairs, and I think they're still around in the family. So they last forever if people have managed to hang on to it through the evolving design trends.
This is the brilliant thing, isn't it, Sandy, that the stuff which is so geographically specific, that this would mean so much to Perth people. You know, it is the thing of your place. It's a glorious thing to sort of celebrate.
Dave and I were just having this conversation yesterday and talking about Catt Furniture. I was like, yeah, my mum and dad had that, and it was our whole house was Catt Furniture back in the 90s. And it really, it makes you think, there's always these constant trends, and, we let go of things. And why? Why do we do that? Why do we always want change? You know, if a piece is beautifully constructed and beautiful, it should be timeless. And I don't know why that is that we tend to move on.
I think one of the nice things about Catt, and it may not be known to, I guess, current generations coming through design schools or whatever it may be, it's kind of in the past. But, Perth does actually have an incredible design history, going back to, you know, post-war architecture, and going through a time, I suppose, where, you know, globalization didn't exist. So everything was designed and made locally for the local market, which is, I guess, how companies like CAT succeeded for so long.
Well, that must, Sandy, be a defining thing about Perth, that if you wanted something done, you had to do it yourself. It is an isolated place.
Well, that's right, and that's exactly how Design Week came about. We wanted it done, so David and I just took it upon ourselves to do it.
That pioneering spirit, it's still strong.
That's it.
One of the discussions, I mean, on that theme, I think, one of the discussions that you're having during the week is one with architectural firm Woods Bagot, and it's looking at how Perth can design its own identity. I wonder if both of you could chip in on that. I mean, Sandy, what does that mean? What is a distinctive Perth design? What elements does that include?
Oh, I think it's actually embracing what we do already. And I guess in the past, there's kind of been this almost like a cringe factor about Perth. And we just have to let go of that and be proud of what we're doing here and acknowledge that, yes, it's different, but different is good. And there was a report done on exactly that topic by an organisation in the city called Committee for Perth. And that the title of the paper was Perth is good, and we need to embrace our differences and our uniqueness and celebrate that and all the good things about our city.
And I wonder, David, if you know, size, sort of a critical mass of a design community within a place is part of that. You get to a certain size and suddenly you get that confidence.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think, thankfully, I mean, the Perth design profession, the design community, is, you know, it is actually pretty sizable. I mean, apart from all the established national firms, I guess, who all have big offices here, there's a whole tier of other practices of different scales that are doing amazing work. I think, well, one of the events that we've got coming up next week is actually a panel discussion which is talking about workplace design, where we've pulled together, I guess, a really diverse range of speakers for this topic, and they range from, you know, I guess, workplace strategy people from Hassle all the way through to, you know, small Fremantle practice. Mm. And so, yeah, there's space for everybody. The market is big enough.
And that's a thing too, Sandy. As soon as you start talking about design, you suddenly start talking about a very wide field. It suddenly becomes an incredibly broad range of ideas.
Well, that's right. And in Perth Design Week, we've got everything from, you know, built form, planning, landscape, architecture, product design, an element of fashion, of graphic design, and, you know, and also art. And, you know, I think it's important to recognise how big the design and creative community is and celebrate that. And by bringing everyone together, I guess you actually realise the scale of it.
Well, congrats, both of you. The first Perth Design Week, it's begun. It's running until March 30. There's a host of free events, and there'll be a link to what's going on in this week to the blueprint page of the Radio National website if you're in Perth, if you're passing through, or if this has inspired you to hop on that big aeroplane and straddle the continent and arrive for Perth Design Week. It'll be worth your while. Sandy, Angie, David Smith, co-founders, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jonathan.
This is Blueprint for Living, ABC RN. On Blueprint for Living, it's time for an icon from the Philippines, I think, Colin Bissett.
Francisco Manosa. Is there such a thing as Filipino architecture? Colonization is a shattering thing, and one of the most visible effects is on the built environment. The Philippines, for instance, was settled by the Spanish in the 1500s, and then by the Americans at the end of the 19th century, with a short, sharp occupation by Japan in the 1940s. and this nation of islands has always been influenced by the various cultures of its neighbours. As a result, the major buildings of the Philippines resemble those of its colonizers' home country, or more recently, the generic international style of the 20th century. Which is why the work of the architect Francisco Manyosa is important. Born in 1931, he studied architecture in Manila before spending a year in Japan. It was there that he was struck how buildings of all types, both new and old, had a particularly Japanese quality. How could this be achieved in the Philippines? Manyosa's buildings are often based on the Bahá'í Cubo, the simple structure set on stilts and with a steeply pitched roof found in lowland areas of the country. But he also worked on an office building for the San Miguel Company, which was inspired by rice paddies, with greenery spilling from its protruding terraces. Probably his most famous building, though, is the Coconut Palace, completed in 1981. With a series of interlinked pavilions, its outstanding element is that it's mainly constructed from the coconut palm, with roof shingles and columns made from its trunks, carpet from its fibre, and even coconut shells transformed into lighting, including spectacular chandeliers. The coconut palm was not only a readily available and ecologically sound resource, but the perfect symbol of national resilience, bending with the wind. The interiors were richly furnished with local marble and hardwood for floors and walls, and other materials such as the capiz shell, giving the windows a gleaming iridescence. With its voluptuous roofline and traditional carving, its mix of shape and material makes the building 100% Filipino. This, it proclaims, is possible. It was intended as a guest house for the president's visitors, the first of whom was to be Pope John Paul II, but he refused to stay in such opulence when there was obvious poverty in the rest of the country. The Coconut Palace was, after all, commissioned by Imelda Marcos, the wife of the president, and famous for her love of excess. Like her infamous shoe collection, the building was seen as just another symbol of the Marcos's extravagance and corruption. Unlike their rule, though, Manyosa's architecture flourished. He designed the EDSA monument that commemorates the People's Movement that removed the Marcoses from power, the couple fleeing in 1986, having embezzled an estimated fortune of over $13 million. This monument again used as its base the Bahá'í Cubo, highlighting the power of the ordinary Filipino. This avaricious period in the history of the country shouldn't diminish the importance of Manyosa's work. The Coconut Palace isn't simply a building of vulgar excess, like, for instance, Ceausescu's palace in Bucharest of the same period. Instead, Manyosa's buildings display a passion to create a new architectural language that is unswervingly Filipino. It's a tricky task, treading the fine line between modern engineering and established tradition without becoming pastiche. Architecture always plays a role in nation building, just as Sydney's Opera House did, outliving the passing parade of politics. And Manyosa's buildings played an important role in establishing a proud and more equable national identity.
Colin, thank you. All Colin's icons gathered for you at the ABC Listen app, which is where you'll find all the things we do here on Blueprint for your listening pleasure at a time of your choosing. We'll be back with a new edition, same time next time. I'm Jonathan Green.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.